Hey everybody, Alan Giannis here, and you're listening to Life Minute TV.
All right, woohoo!
Yes!
Finally, Alan Giannis in the house.
Thank you for the invitation. And actually in person this time,
yes,
right?
Yes, we've spoken so many times, yeah. And we finally got you in person, which is amazing.
I know,
amazing.
Here I am in New York City.
Woohoo! On your amazing U.S. world tour.
Yeah, U.S. and world tour.
Last night, I got to catch the show at the Iridium, which was absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
Tell us about it, how it's been going.
It's been going amazingly well, a lot of fun. I decided in December, after I had a little bit of a health scare, to, you know, but I've been kind of floating around anyway for the last couple of years, not really, just here and there and everywhere. And I decided, like, you know, it was time to get out there and tour a lot more. So I started in March, and there's a really cool band called Earl of Hell, and they booked a tour in the UK. So we basically traveled together. They opened up the show, and then I would play half the set or a little bit less acoustically. And then they'd join me as my band, you know? And so that was the theme. And, you know, so I was just kind of, the guy, just okay, being driven, you know, having a great time, just enjoying life in general there. Some great shows in the UK. Then the same thing happened in Spain with Lost Satellite, you know, the band that produced.
The band you produce, we should say. All these bands you produce.
Yeah. And Earl of Hell, I'm actually working on the new record. It's going to be amazing. I'm mixing it and stuff. And we're going to do some more touring next year together in the UK and Ireland this time. They're from Scotland. They're a great band. And then continuing that theme, I continued on with The Devils, this awesome punk band from Italy, Gianni and Erica. And the same thing. We, you know, toured in Italy. They'd open the show. Then they joined me for some songs after my acoustic set. Continuing on with Patron, French band Loic and company. Same thing, you know, played shows there. Then, I mean, it just kept going. In between, you know, I stopped, like, the production here, production there, with Tara Hu, with Sick Joy. I love working out of the studio called La Casa Murada, just south of Barcelona. And it's one of my favorite studios to work at, so there's a little break in between tours. I go there. Then I joined my dear friends, Masters of Reality, with Chris Goss, and we did a bunch of shows together. And, you know, then I went to Australia and New Zealand. I'm getting tired just telling you all this.
I'm getting tired.
Yeah, it was amazing fun. And then now brings me to the U.S. tour. I found an amazing agency called North Shore Artists, and Scott and I have been traveling together. We're both driving. His tour manager is doing the merch, and it brought us all the way from Nashville all the way to New York, you know, and that's where we ended up yesterday at the Iridium, which was an amazing show.
It was an amazing show, and everybody was just buzzing about it, that standing ovations four times over.
No, it was so sweet. Yeah.
It was just really special and amazing.
Yeah, a great connection. It's like, it's a great feeling, because I didn't know whether I could, you know, even though I've been a part of so much music. Sometimes, you know, people that don't read liners might not know that I was involved or whatever. You know, some of the deep fans came out, and it was a great feeling because I could play songs, you know, from the last 30 years, and people that were fans of that, you know, whether it was 11, you know, Desert Session stuff or my solo work. I love it when there's a connection with the audience and I can open up to them and it becomes a circle of energy. And next thing you know, I'm playing and singing better than I possibly imagined I could, you know, which is a great feeling. And that's what happened yesterday. It was a, you know, really, really amazing night.
Yeah, so. People were crying, myself included. You have had an incredible career. Songs that you've written that people don't know about.
Yeah.
Gosh, from the work with Chris Cornell, mm-hmm. Euphoria Morning that you, yeah. you know, wrote and produced. Queens of the Stone Age, yes. Desert Sessions. Tell us about that.
Well, obviously with Euphoria Morning, it was an amazing period in our lives, you know, Natasha and I were already fans of Soundgarden. When we both ended up on tour together, you know, they were listening to us, we were listening to them, and they invited us to open up for them and began this long friendship, you know. And we'd open up for them, and they invited Natasha to guest on the record, and we just had this beautiful friendship and connection. So when Chris decided to do his first solo record, he stayed with us for a while. We wrote a bunch of songs together and prepared material. Meanwhile, we had a studio in the house because of him, because when he was staying with us, he invited Al Cafaro, the president of A&M Records, that was their label, to come and listen to our stuff. And he loved it so much, he offered us a record deal. Then Natasha and I were ballsy enough to walk into his office and ask for the budget as a PO for the music store, so we could use it the entire amount to buy equipment to build a studio in the house, which we did. And he said yes, which is incredible. And then we did have a guard dog like that. We had a studio at the house already. And once we developed these songs with Chris, he was going to work with Daniel Lanois. And Daniel canceled a bunch of his projects. And so Chris was like, what are you going to do? And Natasha was like, we're going to start recording tomorrow. No one needs to know. We're right here. We're going to do it. And so we did Euphoria Morning at 11 AD, which is the name of the home studio that we had. And that was just one of the most amazing creative periods of my life. 7 months making the record, a year and a half touring it. You know, to me, it's one of the most special. It's a real highlight creatively. That connection with Chris and Natasha, the three of us, you know, just had this amazing shorthand. And it was a lot of fun because we were completely outside of any kind of pressure of like needing to show anything to anybody or expensive studios or any of that stuff. So it was really great.
It sounded just beautiful. That was amazing. Nothing like
it. Yeah, and then right after that period, we ended up on Interscope, you know, because A&M became Interscope, you know, because Avant Garde Dog was postponed to come out after Euphoria Morning, but sadly it got sold, and we became suddenly, we were label mates with Queens of the Stone Age. That whole connection started, the relationship and the friendship. Josh invited me to record some B-sides for Rated R at Sound City Studios, and from there he told us about Desert Sessions. This amazing idea and concept that you get together with a bunch of people, some of them you've never met, and the idea is to make a record in several days from scratch, you know, recorded and composed in just a short period of time and making new connections, new friendships. And sometimes songwriters have a longer process for this, you know, like they develop the songs and they tweak them, they fine tune them, but this is more like visceral, in the moment, energy is everything, spontaneity is everything. You know, not a bunch of takes, you just get one or, you know. So in that 7 and 8 is when I wrote Hanging Tree and Making a Cross. And then Josh asked if they could record that for Songs for the Deaf. So he went in, also part of that record. I'm like the Mexican DJ, I'm playing like theremin and flutes and some guitars and stuff at Ebo on Hanging Tree. I met Mark Lanigan at that session, which began a long, you know, beautiful collaboration and friendship too. And then the next one, 9 and 10, is when I met PJ Harvey through Josh again, you know. And it's just amazing. What a beautiful place to meet and place for like a musical family tree to expand from, you know. Josh is very instrumental and very important in that kind of the way people come together around his the sphere that he creates.
You told a funny story last night about that, about how you wrote that song.
Yeah.
And they left you hanging.
The credits got messed up and my name wasn't on as one of the writers in the first 100, I think several thousand, you know, maybe 100,000 of the vinyl. And so I was telling my friends, oh, wait, you hear this cool song that I wrote? And they're like, no, you didn't write. What are you talking about? And I'm, look, I got the credits right here. I was like, oops.
On Sound City, I don't think they fixed it. Your name, I noticed, wasn't on
there. Oh, on the last credits, yeah. I was told they were there. I was actually watching when they said, no, it was there. I was like, oh, okay. I'm kind of the man in the shadows, as it were. Not because I chose to be. I just my personality is more team, you know. You know, go team, no I in team. Relationship is very important to me, whether it's connection with just another person or a group of people. I think you can achieve amazing things when you join forces and you selflessly, with at least ego or at least the negative aspect of ego, leave that to the side and just work towards something amazing, you know, something timeless. That's why I always feel so good inside, you know. At the same time, it's really strange because I've made solo records in which I work exclusively by myself. But it's strange because I still feel like Natasha's presence, you know, with me. So in a way, it's still like collaborating. She's like so deeply inside my psyche, my mind, and my soul. So I can almost access her internally, you know, like asking advice or in the form of a spontaneous decision, you know, or just like trusting. That's a big part of my solo album process is trusting, you know, that and not overthinking it, you know. It doesn't have to be perfect, you know. It has to have the energy of the initial inception, or rather, I think of it more of a transmission that I've been preparing all my life to receive and manifest as much of a totality as possible, you know?
That's a beautiful way to look at it.
I mean, it's what it feels like to me, you know? I don't feel like I own any of it or like I did, you know? It's more like, it's just out there, you know?
How does it all happen for you? Like, you know, how does it come? Like, do lyrics come first or music come first?
You know, lyrics usually come after, and which is funny, but there's already imagery inherent in the melody and the harmony and the lyrics and the atmosphere of the song. You know, whether it has longing or melancholy or anger or whatever. And sometimes it's like when I'm first kind of improvising the fragments, like which I do on Instagram very often, some kind of vocalese will come, some words, you know. They're not really words, it's sounds. And sometimes the vocalization sticks and becomes kind of like the central thing, you know, even more than, you know, whatever. And then it just kind of flows out. So I don't think I've actually recorded a vocal singing a lyric I've memorized because I just wrote it. I'm actually reading it as I'm singing it, almost like interpreting it in the moment, reacting to it, you know, because it's so fast, it's so quick. And I just kind of convinced myself that, well, first of all, I feel like this pressure building up. It's not a bad pressure, it's just like kind of feeling like something's ready to pop, you know? And so then I just wait for that moment, and then I kind of set up the environment so that I can pull it off, like, okay, nothing to do for a week, or, you know, get the instruments ready, put some mics up, you know, and then just like listen for it and then just start, you know? And once I start, then it starts to move. It's almost like a dam where you just open the thing up and whoosh, it starts to flow, you know? And that's what happened with Hum. Like 12 days later, I had a whole record. And when I started with a chord sequence for the first song, and I just imagined the entire album in sequence, and I kept listening for the next song, and each day I would basically compose, record, mix, and put that song to bed by the evening, and the next morning listen to those first two songs, and then what's the third song? Then what's the fourth song, you know? That was the process for Hum, you know, that was quite intense. And on that one, I had Mark Lanigan was home, and he was on the other line. He was on the text. I would email him quick MP3 bounces of where I was at, and he was amazing in just giving me input, like, yeah, let's go, this is good. Oh, it needs a little, you know, like that. It was like having a producer or something, too. That was a really amazing feeling. Because it was usually the other way around, because yeah. I've been producing his records.
You.
Yeah, he had my back. It's like we had this very great natural way of like it was understood, like he could actually approach it like, as if everything that he heard in his mind, I would, you know, try to manifest for him, you know? And he didn't necessarily have to be super clear about what he heard. I just had a feeling the way he was expressing it, and like, as I was searching of how he was reacting to what I was doing. It's not like he knew when it was right, you know? So I just had to make him feel good about it so that he would want to sing it. And then we would add a few touches at the end, and that was the process. Usually only about 4 or 5 hours per song, you know? And then, of course, the guests, you know, they would add their stuff. But the core of the song, that was usually the process, you know?
You're so eclectic, and you've done it. You've had so many bands, you know? Mm-hmm. But you can always hear that it's you, that you've touched something, whether, you know,
awesome.
You know, and even things you produce. How is it different for you producing or doing your own solo stuff?
I mean, like, I look at it as part of the same process. I'm really good at sensing what is needed, and I don't want to derail someone else's process. So some bands want you, you know, it feels like they want help in songwriting or whatever. Some are just happy to be in an environment that is caring and loving and supportive, you know, and fun. And sometimes, this is what I do. I'm very vocal and honest about what I hear. Like, this could be better if it had this. And then I don't say it needs something. I just have possibilities to play you of what it could be. And then immediately, when they're getting to know your process, it becomes this, like, everyone in the room knows when it's right, you know? So it's not even like the suggestions I come up with are already within the realm of what feels right for it, you know? I'm really good at kind of absorbing a paradigm or a worldview of a particular artist and then figuring out what is assistive in that situation. There's a sound, maybe, but there's definitely like a process that happens every time I'm involved with something, you know? And so far I've been really lucky. There's only been one situation, maybe even two, in 20 some years where it didn't work, where I was incapable of stopping a self-sabotage, you know, and that artist, like, there was no way that anything was gonna work. They made sure of that. But it's really interesting, and it's the same process as for myself. It's a slightly more forward or, you know, supportive role. Either it's like a lead role or a supportive role, but it's all to me the same thing. I just look at it like a continuum of a creative process that is based on communication, you know, like communicating human experiences, communicating the possibilities, you know, the beauty of life. Something that, you know, because music has that power to help us, you know, and be there for us whenever there's tremendous suffering or tremendous happiness or all of the entire pendulum from one side to the other. Music can be there, and that's why I love a lot of the albums I've been a part of. People come up to me after the shows and they thank me for being a part of something that helped them through their hard years or like define a period in their lives or is still helping them now. With my album For Natasha, which was based on dealing with the grief and the pain and the suffering, at the same time honoring the beauty of having been so lucky to have spent 25 years with someone so incredible, and the love that you know there was. A lot of people that have experienced grief are moved by that album, and they come up and they tell me, and they, you know, it feels really amazing to you know, that there's, I mean, being entertained is a beautiful thing too, but it's really amazing when it has a deeper meaning for people, you know, because it does for me. Music is, like, that's the happiest that I am whenever I'm in a creative environment. It doesn't always have to be music. As long as the creative environment can be, like, when I'm around my you know, painter friends or poet friends, it's like it's a particular antidote to all the negative aspects of existence, you know?
How did you know you wanted to be a musician?
I was four, but I remember, like, you know, yeah, I mean, it's pretty young, but I was very fortunate that my uncles and my mom, and, you know, they were all in music. They were all more in the performer, entertainer world, but my Uncle Peter was a multi-instrumentalist, you know, and a huge personality. And so there was always music in the house. And he would show up and he would be playing trumpet or flute or drums and guitar, and my mom was singing, you know. The music was a big part of everything. And I don't know, I just, like, immediately gravitated to what I felt when I listened. And then also I looked at him and fascination with the instruments and the sounds they would make. And I felt like a resonance with it, like, and almost like a certainty that was for me, that I could be good at it, you know. So he showed me a few chords on the guitar, and I went in, and I got more serious as time went on. I was enjoying music, and, you know, listening to a lot of Beatles. I would make my mom, you know, buy me vinyl and stuff and singles, you know, much more than, like, you know, toy soldiers or cars or guns or whatever. It was more about the music. And then just the more I played. And then some key events, like having really cool neighbors that would gift me, like, a Paco de Lucia record, so I heard flamenco guitar for the first time. Then Zeppelin and Hendrix appeared, and there was a lot of music being played, and I was already keyed into it. Because I was living in so many different places, you know, my family always traveling, I started to be exposed to different kinds of music and different cultures. And I started to see it all as one thing. You know, there was beautiful differences, but there was the common thread, you know. That's why I became so fascinated with instruments. You know, that's why I have 300 of them in storage. Not just guitars, you know.
300.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I mean, I used to
thought
even
it was
have
more, actually. Yeah,
it's
over
probably
400.
More. I mean, I don't. I had never counted, to be honest with you, but I have so many things that, you know.
Somebody said once, I want to steal it. I don't remember who it was, but the guy has over 400 instruments, and what's most astounding is that he can actually play every single one of them, and they're all different instruments.
Well, I mean, I'm not a virtuoso really on any of them, but I can use them in a musical context to communicate something important with the sound that instrument makes. That's what fascinated me about it. Plus, I love how they look, you know, Indian classical instruments, you know, Arabic instruments, African instruments, you know, Slavic instruments, Celtic instruments, like South American instruments. There's like a common thing to them, like with strings and then things with heads and then like winds. They are the personality and the face of a culture, but yet they also can reach across. I mean, there's people that listen to music from other countries that didn't grow up in that culture, and yet it moves them. Even when you don't understand the lyric, you get moved in a universal way, you know? And obviously, like, you know, it's a little frustrating sometimes. It's like, what is the lyric here, you know? What is it? But beyond that, something is being transmitted and received, you know? And I've just been fascinated with that, you know? That's why I collect, and I pick up a new instrument every year or two. I just wish I had enough time to. And I keep picking quite difficult ones to get good at, because a lot of the discipline it takes, you know, you have to be a kid and start to be a virtuoso. You have to be playing it, you know, 10 hours a day since you're...
I think you're okay.
Yeah, six, yeah.
I think
you. But I mean, like I said, the goal is not to be a virtuoso or even to use it to play music from where it comes from, you know. I'm not going to play a raga on a sitar or a sarod, you know. I listen to them all the time, but I'm going to use it as in the song I hear that sound, you know, it's that texture that I want, that kind of phrasing, you know. Then I have that instrument, I practice the part for like whatever an hour before, and I record it.
What do you mean by texture?
The texture is the way that it sounds and what it does and the atmosphere of the song for orchestration. Like,
you know,
like you have one line that can have, like, say, an alto flute with a sarod with a harmonium. You know, that's one sound together playing a line. And then what if it was like a marxophone with a, you know, like, so it's like, it's so beautiful because these are tonal colors, you know, that convey something or can underscore something in what you're conveying, either lyrically or in the atmosphere of the song.
Well, you of know? Course, we know you did it with Euphoria Morning, Chris Cornell, mm-hmm. and Desert Sessions, but for the new bands that you produce now, do you ever just, like, you know, pick up an instrument and play for them?
Oh, too? Yeah, I mean, I've been playing a lot of guest guitar, like Lost Satellite and Patron. I play bass sometimes, and sometimes I add some other colors too, which is really nice because it's nice because I get to guest on something and just part of the
film. More than producing. Producer extraordinaire.
Well, you know, I try not to like insist or anything, but
it's too
but
modest.
If they ask me, then I'm down, and usually I wait till they ask me. You know, I play hard to get for a second.
Self-taught.
Yes.
Incredible. You can't read music.
I cannot. No, I could have, but I had a really unpleasant teacher, the first one I had for a few months. He was kind of a sadist, so I equated, like, physical pain with learning to read and all that stuff. So, but obviously that's completely incorrect. I was just unlucky. I just didn't understand. But then I just went on this journey of, like, also this part of me that loves the feeling of the innocence of picking something up for the first time and the excitement when it's a mystery still. So I kind of like managed for, well, how many years now? 58 years now? Yeah. 58 years to keep it mysterious, you know, because I play instruments and then I can figure things out. I can figure out, like, if I look at this chart or you know, sheet music, I know what that note is. I know what this rhythm is. It takes me a second, you know, and I figure what the notes in this chord are and how it works in the harmony. I've been around it long enough for that. But it's not what happens first. What happens first is I hear it in my mind, and then I try to make the time between hearing it and playing it to be as short as possible, you know? So it's very instinctive, you know? And when I grab an instrument, I just try, it's just the excitement of, like, how do you get that to, like, what am I, how do I get the sound to be better, bigger, like, you know, and listen to amazing virtuosos on the instrument. And then I try to see some footage and I figure things out. I start off sounding awful, and then within a day, I'm sounding okay, you know? And then maybe 2 days, I'm sounding better than that. And then at some point, I get enough confidence that I can actually use it on a recording, you know? But I kind of lean on the cool, like texture of, like, drunken sailors playing stuff, you know? So it's got a vibe, like, you know, like, you know? That's where your intonation doesn't have to be perfect. I'm kind of like, create you know, the circus or macabre or that kind of vibe in some of this stuff.
And where did that come from?
Just listening to all kinds of music. I like a lot of Tom Waits records have this amazing textures, you know, and the way the things are played and feel. To me, feel is very important. And, you know, I found very often, like, you can hire people that are amazing players, and to get them to understand how it should sit inside the track is more difficult than if you already know how it sits and what it's supposed to be doing. And I just thought, you know, whatever. It's a good hobby to have, collect instruments. And I use them, you know, displayed everywhere too. You know, it's not like they're in cases and being kept, you know, like ooh, you know, like literally just over here. Like I have to, like at 11 AD, you know, like when the temperature changed in, you know, California, like the entire house is like strings going bing, boom, getting loose, you know. Every day I was tuning, like, all these instruments, you know.
You're like a human AI with a guitar. You just take it, watching you, like, last night, fingers.
It's been quite a journey. I'm looking forward to much more.
What about your voice? Did you always know you could sing?
I was kind of the default singer in the beginning. I could sing, but you know.
You have a beautiful voice.
Well,
you really do. We always talk about Natasha's voice, but your guitar playing is so insane.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
that
Natasha,
I think everybody
was, you
sees
know,
that.
Singer, her voice, Mark Lanigan, Chris Cornell, these are singers, you know, like real singers, and in the sense that, you know, I want to communicate the song, and I think I've been getting better, especially after I quit stupidly with smoking for a while, and I quit smoking a few years ago, right before the pandemic, which probably helped me survive getting COVID that bad, that early. Yeah, I mean, I could probably focus and develop it much more seriously in terms of the technical aspect of it. But it's a, like, again, like everything else, it's very, very visceral for me. But one of the first bands we had with Hillel Slovak, Jack Irons, and I, since we were in junior high, I was a default singer. But often I wanted to play guitar and not have to worry about singing, you know, and do both. But yeah, but Natasha had the amazing voice. But I'm glad that people enjoy my voice. I'm glad that's good.
That's beautiful. And you can hear every word you say, which I love.
Thank you.
I love. Tell us about, you mentioned it a little bit, the Hillel, the whole L.A. scene,
yeah,
Orange County scene.
It was an amazing time.
Pretty
much a year after I got to the States, went to Bancroft Junior High, met Jack in a really unusual way. Those guys were really into Kiss, and they dressed up as Kiss with these amazingly elaborate costumes. And we both had homeroom together, you know. And I didn't speak very much English yet. I was just learning it. And he sat behind me, and he was walking down the aisle with his Gene Simmons outfit. And I don't know what got into me, but as he's walking by, he's got the cod piece, you know, the metallic looking thing like in his outfit. And I just went like, I punched it like lightly, thinking that, you know, it must be protective, you know. And he's like, ow, you know, you asshole. And he told Hillel, this kid, like, he's a punchy, he goes, what does he look like? Oh, he goes, oh, that guy's really good guitar player. We should jam with him, you know. So we started jamming together. And then we literally would go every day after school to Jack's house and had our stuff set up. And then we didn't get a bass player until 10th grade. And then Todd, our bass player, then quit. And Flea was our friend that played trumpet, Michael Balzer. And we asked him to join the band because we had a battle of the bands at Gazzari's in 3 months' time, you know. And that's where the origins of Anthem, you know, the first band
Anthem,
we had.
So good,
yeah,
so
and
heavy.
Those recordings were great, too. We just recently unearthed and became What Is This? And then Flea left to join Fear. We got Chris Hutchinson, and, you know, and the Peppers and What Is This coexisted for a while. And then we both got a record deal offers the same week, and Hillel and Jack stayed with me. That's rather, even though they were founding members of the Peppers, they're not on the very first record, you know. So Hillel left first during the Todd Rundgren produced long play of What Is This? Natasha joined the band, and then Jack went back to the Peppers. Natasha and I were just a duo for a while. And then after Hillel passed away, Jack quit, and then Natasha, Jack, and I formed 11 in 1990.
Hillel Slovak, he's like an iconic figure. He was so young when he passed.
Yeah, he's 27. Him and I were closest, I think. We spent the most time together. Like, he would come stay over. We loved music so much together, and we had a really great connection. When he passed away, Natasha and I were in England, and Jack called, and it destroyed me, like, both of us, you know. It was like our first huge death, you know. We had been a little bit estranged for a while. You know, he was in the Peppers now, and he started using drugs, and I wasn't that person, you know. He kind of, like, our friendship started to strain a little because he wanted me to join him in that kind of, like, world of, you know, a little more, you know, kind of like William Burroughs, Henry Miller, like the dark side, you know, a little bit of a hanging out. And it wasn't for me, you know, because I remember when the drug use started to happen, like the band started to sound bad for the first time, you know. It was the next morning or whatever. I was very serious about the music sounding good. So the second anything got in the way of that, I rejected it, you know. But still, so I went into a deep tailspin depression, anxiety, panic attacks, and the whole thing. That kind of triggered the first kind of breakdown, you know, and for Jack as well. It's funny when I think about what life could have been like if he would have been. But he was an incredible force as a guitar player, as a musician. And it was, you know, I had been playing way longer than them, you know, but something, there were adult bands and people older than me that wanted me to be part of their band because I was quite good already, you know, way beyond our teenage years, you know, in terms of like whatever that is considered, but good enough to be offered to be in bands with older people, with adults. But something about Hillel and Jack, like our connection together, they'd only been playing a couple of years when we first started, but I was there because we, you know, almost like I waited for them a little tiny bit, you know, they were getting better off really fast. And I just loved playing together and the friendship and all the things that we did. Yeah, so that was Fairfax High was a big, you know, meeting place. I mean, Slash went there, Rami Jaffe, tons of actors and painters, and just a really amazing Keith Barry, who was who ran Flea's Conservatory. You know, he was a the jazzer, and he was a jazz man in the group of friends. Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful time.
That's amazing. Didn't you just, wasn't there an honorary?
Yes, I got a Hall of Fame. And my sister's friend was there, and she took the little medal for me. I posted a little video that she took. Yeah, I couldn't be there because I was on tour. But yeah, Herb Albert too, you know, from A&M.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he went there too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I remember seeing Demi Moore there she was there for 1 year.
Really?
Yeah. It was a great, I mean, that's the neighborhood that I lived in since 74, you know. I lived next to the Whiskey and the Roxy and the Tower Records and the Viper Room at the time was Filthy McNasty's. Then it became the Central, and the Central had amazing Monday night jams where I jammed with Mitch Mitchell and, you know, met Jack Bruce, and it was just great stuff.
And the Natasha connection, there's nothing like that.
So Aaron Jacobus was our buddy in school, and he was our manager. And then for some reason, he wasn't anymore, and then he kind of used that energy to, I'll show them, you know. And he started working for A&M Records. And he saw Natasha on TV. She had done some movies, but she was talking about music. Because, you know, he found her and brought her in for an interview to ask her, you know, what do you want to do? I'm interested in your music. You're awesome. I said, well, yes, thank you. But I'd love to find another. You know, I want to collaborate and I want to just form a duo, you know. And it took him a second to bring her over to meet me, you know, like a few months, because he kept taking her to like famous people that had gold records on the wall, and she wasn't impressed with anybody. The night before we met, I had a dream I was going to meet her, which is essentially me, you know, clearing in the forest, and there's a seesaw, and it's too dark, I can't see her. But we're going like this, counterbalancing each other. So my name is Natasha, we're going to meet. And the next day, Aaron Jacobus brought her over to the house to meet me. And I told my mom about the dream, and she opened the door. I was in my room. My mom remembers, like, opening the door. This Aaron goes, here's Natasha. Natasha remembers my mom going, whoa, what, you know? And literally, like, we met, and at first I thought I recognized, like, we recognized each other for a second. And then it just kind of, the thing came down. And then, you know, she played me her stuff that she'd done at Motown, and I loved it. I played her Was This, and we started to work on some music together, and then within 2 weeks, we moved in together, you know? I was like 22 years old, and that was at 25 years later, you know, a little more. It was amazing. We just had this connection from day one, and we spent 24/7 for all that time, you know? Like, when our friends started to have kids that could start to speak, they would call us both the same name, Alan and Natasha. Alan and Natasha, you know, and that's what it felt like. Obviously, completely individual, you know. So she wasn't shy by any means. I like to think of it like we both of us made like one super, super person, you know. Like everything that we each one had slightly missing, the other one.
But that voice and that.
Yeah. And her musicality, just period. Just her genius as a composer, as an arranger. Like she was being groomed to be the next amazing Russian composer, classical music, you know, when she was just 10, you know, conservatory. Like she just had those ears. She could listen to a piece of music and remember everything that was played, you know. Completely the opposite of me, which that's why I think it all worked so well, you know. But she was also very improvisational, you know. She could read and she could play and she could, but it, like she could compose like without instruments, you know. She's just like hearing that and seeing and then, you know. So that was the one tricky part when we worked together, because I was trying to find something on the guitar. She's like, shh. I was like, okay. Or she'd be like, I hear this. Okay, you play this. And I'd be like, on the guitar, I'd be like, I'm stretching to get all the notes that she wants to hear, like this chord. I'm like, okay, I got the chord, but now what? I was like, just going to stay here for a while. But now I need to go over here. I was like, okay. She goes, what kind of an instrument is that? All kinds of things get unjogged, as it were.
Let's talk about your solo work a little. Mm-hmm. And what's next? How many solo albums do you have?
I have three. I have Spark for Natasha, Fragments and Holes Volume 1, which I did in 2015, and Hum, which I did in 2021. Yeah. I'm going to go to Santiago in December and spend 2-3 months there at least. I need to finish the album with my trio, with Cote Fonseca and Fela Fonseca. We have a few songs that we started. We have one that everyone's heard that with Mike Patton guested on it called Luna Sol. Trying to do it remotely, but I've also been touring so much. We need to be together in the same place. So there's going to be a good window of time to finish that. And I need to do the volume two of Fragments and Holes. So I don't have any plan beyond like knowing that that's what I'm going to do. And then when I start, it'll just kind of appear.
You gotta stop, you know, producing everyone else and work on your own stuff. Some new stuff.
I'm producing a couple of things coming up and doing some dates in Seattle, and some shows in November. But then I got in Spain with a Radio 75, a cool band that I produced. And then I think I'm gonna head to Chile. You know, I need to take care of a couple of things with my health, and that's gonna be the plan for the immediate future. There's some touring already with Masters of Reality next year. With Earl of Hell, we got a UK, Ireland, Scotland tour coming up, and I'd love to come back to the States and tour some more and continue, you know, doing both things. But it's definitely time to put out some music now. Yeah. I feel more of an urgency to do that more often, you know, instead of waiting 5 years between 2010, 2015, and 2022, you know, 21.
This is Life Minute. What's your life advice?
I somehow keep retaining that childlike wonder about things, you know? I mean, especially now with so much adversity and people behaving so awfully to each other in social media and this kind of tightening and closing. It's like everything is open and yet everything is tighter, you know? Like information is out there, but most of it is lies. And really, you know, all this craziness like happening and the division, you know? And what keeps me going through that is like I focus on the beautiful things in my life, you know, the deep friendships, you know, the beautiful things that I love. It's like nature, animals, you know, art, all that stuff. And I try to wake up each day. First of all, wake up extremely thankful that I have another day. And I try not to dwell on the past too much. It's more like honor it and be thankful for the good things that have happened, not like regret things as much. And I try not to be afraid of what's coming. Like, nobody knows. So because of so many years of having the anxiety disorder and depression and kind of like nervous things, you know, it's like where somehow, luckily, I've managed to figure out a way to quiet my mind, you know, because if I let it, the chatter, it won't stop. So I kind of have a couple of tricks. I have a couple of affirmation mantras that I keep repeating in the background when the trigger on wherever I'm uncomfortable or something. In my mind, there's a part that says, I love and approve of myself. I trust the process of life. I am safe. I love and approve of myself. I trust the process. And it's just sitting there, you know? Like I turned it on like a cassette, you know? If my brain is going to be doing something bad, I'd rather it just repeat these phrases that make me feel good, you know? You should have, you could have, blah, 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 and, you know, you'll never, you know, and all that. Who knows where that voice comes from, but I think we all have it, you know, self-doubt. And so why give it any real estate at all in your thought process? Or at least realize it's there and just treat it as what it is. It's just a little, it's nothing, you know, just bye. I think your subconscious doesn't realize what a big difference between what you're living and what you're thinking, you know, so it takes a while to figure this stuff out, you know. Hopefully, well, it's just some time left to enjoy things. So obviously I don't have perfect days all the time, but the overall tendency is to be more positive. Really, unreasonably so, considering a lot of things that are happening, but you know, why not, right?
I love it. That's cool. Awesome.
Awesome.
And you're gonna play for us?
Yes, I'd love to play for you. Eyes up to the sky, shades of gray. Covering up an infinite display. Well, he's spinning out, oh, you're so still. All that freedom tempered by my will. Be the motion of becoming. Dance a deadly dance while time is running. Thank you. See the breeze caressing where you end, only to begin again and then. A deeper sense awaken when I start, trying so hard to fiddle what it's not. Oh, the motion of becoming, dance a deadly dance while time is running. It's called Eyes to the Sky. I'm gonna have to play something from Spark. This is called Return to You. Sessions version, the OG version of Hanging Tree. Oh,
summer sound as we do a walk.
Song from Howling Book. Thank you.
to see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.